AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
If you saw this man, don't talk to him. That's a pretty stark warning, isn't it?
It really is. And it's tied directly, explicitly to the source material we're diving into today.
Yeah. And this isn't just some, you know, vague old wives' tale. It's specific, localized, comes straight out of 1920s California, that mix of sunshine and, well, something darker. Superstition lurking right there on the busy pier.
Exactly. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're looking at a really unusual figure, Poofington, the lamp merchant of the pier.
Poofington, even the name sounds off.
It does, doesn't it? And he exists right on that blurry line between, let's say, historical record and outright myth. It's a story that seems to blend everything. Pierside business, deep-seated superstition, people vanishing.
And strangely mundane stuff, too, like neighboring shopkeepers getting set up.
Right. They just wanted this this creepy, probably dangerous neighbor gone. It affected their business, their safety. So it's this mix of the supernatural and the very practical.
So the material we have today, it's quite a mix. It really forces you to constantly adjust your focus, doesn't it? Between what's documented and what sounds, well, impossible.
That's the core challenge. We've got eyewitness reports. Some sound pretty hysterical, frankly. But then we also have official petition records, signed, logged, from competing businesses.
Tangible stuff.
Absolutely. And then there are these later analyses trying to unpack what Poofington, this reverse wish granter, actually represented to people back then.
Okay, so our mission today, as we dive in, is to kind of navigate that tension, to pull out the facts, the records, the community action, the deaths from all the imagery, the wild stories.
Precisely. I'll be focusing on trying to anchor us in those facts, establish the timelines, look at the economic context, the documented actions that prove this wasn't just a ghost story for some people. Real action was taken.
Okay, and I get to dive into the more atmospheric side. The symbols, the setting, those really bizarre claims that made this guy stick in people's minds became this legend.
Sounds like a plan.
So to really get this, you have to let us take you back. Imagine stepping onto those wooden planks, Pacific Ocean underneath, slap bang in the middle of the roaring 20s.
Yeah, let's start right there. The setting. Because where this shop was located, that's absolutely critical to the whole story's power.
Okay, so picture it. A 1920s California pier. It's probably buzzing, right? Super vibrant.
Oh, absolutely. Sensory overload is a good way to put it. Bright sunshine, maybe some fog rolling in later, but mostly loud, bustling, vacationers dressed up.
You'd hear the calliope music from a carousel, maybe. Barkers shouting about games.
Exactly. The smell of popcorn, maybe frying fish, salt air, and always, beneath it all, the sound of the waves crashing against the pilings. It's a place built on optimism, quick fun, quick commerce.
Instant gratification.
That's the key. Everything's immediate. Fun now, buy now. And that's the contrast that makes Poofington's place so jarring.
Because his shop wasn't like that at all.
Not according to any of the sources. While everything else is lit up, maybe even garish with neon starting to appear, carnival lights. His place was described as, well, visually wrong. It was a shop physically built right out at the very edge of the pier.
Like the end of the line.
Pretty much. Where the man-made structure met the, you know, the big, dark, unknown ocean.
And it was called the Dim Lamp Shop. Which is ironic, right?
Yeah.
A lamp shop that's dim.
Highly ironic. The sources say it looked legitimate enough from the outside. Maybe a bit run down, but always, always shadowed, even on a bright day.
So you'd be walking along this bright, noisy pier, and then you hit this pocket of quiet, of shadow.
Exactly. The interior lights were kept low. It created this immediate sense of being apart from the rest of the pier's energy. It looked like a shop, but it felt different. It housed something else entirely.
Something arcane, you said.
Yes.
And ultimately deadly.
Yes. And folklore, especially coastal folklore, loves those threshold places, doesn't it?
The edge of the land, the edge of the known.
Right. Where the human world, the world of commerce and prosperity, the pier, meets the primal unknown, the uncontrollable, the ocean, the darkness. Poofington set up shop right on that line, literally.
Okay, so let's talk about the man himself. Coofington, the proprietor. We know he ran this lamp store, but that wasn't his real business, was it?
No, the lamps seem almost like props in retrospect. What he was really selling wasn't illumination, it was, well, consequence.
And his business proposition, it was just out there, posted, amidst all the other stalls selling taffy and souvenirs.
Apparently so. Right there in the hustle and bustle. And it was, let's just say, unconventional. Shocking, really.
He was offering three wishes, guaranteed to come true. Is that right?
That's the quote from the sources. Guaranteed.
Okay. And the price?
The price was $150.
Wow. Okay, so $150. We need to unpack that, don't we? Most people, you said, just thought it was a scam. A crazy, expensive scam.
And they stayed away, wisely. But that price point, $150 in the late 1920s, we really need to anchor that in reality to understand the stakes.
Right, because it sounds like a lot, but how much was it? What does that tell us?
It's absolutely critical. $150 then was, well, it was a huge amount of money for the average person. We're talking possibly several months' wages for a laborer.
Seriously, months.
Oh, yes. Or think about what else it could buy. Maybe a down payment on a basic car like a Model T Ford. Or several months' rent for a decent apartment in a city.
So this wasn't like, oh, I'll take a flyer on this for fun.
Absolutely not. It wasn't pocket change. It was a significant, potentially life-altering amount of money to risk.
Which means the people who actually paid it, they weren't casual thrill seekers.
Exactly. The price itself acts as this incredibly effective filter. Poofington wasn't aiming for volume. He wasn't trying to fleece everyone for a few dollars.
He wanted specific customers.
It seems so. Either someone wealthy enough that $150, while large, was a risk they could take for something extraordinary, or someone utterly desperate, someone willing to gamble everything they had on that guarantee.
And the high price.
Yeah.
It almost makes the offer seem more real, doesn't it? More substantial.
Paradoxically, yes. It confers a weight, a seriousness to the transaction. If he'd offered wishes for a dollar, it's just a cheap carnival trick. At $150, it feels like you're purchasing something of immense, almost dangerous value.
So you're buying into the power, the life change, and the price tag reflects that scale.
Yeah.
It locks you into the contract.
It anchors the whole thing in a very concrete economic reality, which makes what happens next, the reversal, feel less like random magic and more like the deliberate execution of a very specific, very costly contract.
It uses the familiar system of commerce
as the doorway to something deeply unfamiliar and terrifying. You walked in willingly, you paid the price, you believed in the value, or at least hoped for it desperately.
It wasn't an impulse buy, it was a calculated risk, or maybe an act of sheer desperation.
Yeah.
And that makes the fallout so much worse.
Okay, so now we get to the heart of it, the consequences. For the handful of people who actually went through with it, paid the $150, made their wishes.
And sources are really clear on this part, right? The promise, the guarantee, it was completely bogus, but not in the way you'd expect.
Not at all. This wasn't just a case of, oh, the magic didn't work, I got ripped off, that would be a simple scam. This was different, more structured, more sinister.
This is where it really shifts gears, from just a weird pure business to actual calculated terror. The key detail is whatever they wished for.
The complete opposite happened.
Not just nothing happened, the exact reverse.
Yes. If they wished for wealth, they faced ruin. If they wished for love, they found devastating loss or isolation. Health wishes led to catastrophic illness. It wasn't failure. It was a perfect mirror image destructive reversal.
Lives ruined completely, as the sources put it.
That phrase comes up repeatedly. And we need to pause on that concept of the opposite. Think about the psychology of that.
Yeah, because simple failure, you can rationalize that. Okay, I was an idiot, it was a scam, but the exact opposite happening.
It implies intent. It implies a power that understands your deepest desire well enough to invert it perfectly. It suggests a deliberate, highly organized system.
He wasn't just a con man. He was like an engine of anti-wishes.
Precisely. It's not random bad luck. It's precision-engineered catastrophe. Poofington wasn't incompetent. He was horrifyingly competent at delivering the opposite of what was paid for. Consequence, not desire.
It's like You didn't just miss the target. The target flew back and hit you. The universe itself seems to conspire in this reversal, meticulously, step by step, undoing your life based on what you wanted most.
And the outcome of this perfect reversal, it was uniform and fatal. Which brings us to the timeline.
Right. The sources mention a specific time frame.
They do. Within 1 year, just 1 year of making their wishes at Poofington Shop, every single person who had paid the $150 died.
Every single one.
Every single one mentioned in the reports associated with this. Now, the records are frustratingly vague on how they died. They just use this blanket phrase, under tragic circumstances.
Which is almost creepier, isn't it? It's not like they were struck by lightning instantly. It unfolded over months.
Exactly. It suggests the reversal wasn't necessarily instantaneous supernatural punishment. It worked away at them, dismantling their lives, finances, relationships, health, until the ultimate tragic end. That consistency.
Yeah.
1 year, every customer, exact opposite result, then death. That's what turned him from just a weirdo running a scam into this figure of legend, real terror.
Okay, so this fits into a pattern we see elsewhere, right? The fatal trap archetype.
Oh, absolutely. It's a classic theme in folklore worldwide. You know, think about the original Aladdin stories, not the sanitized versions, getting immense power or treasure quickly. It's almost always a trap.
There's always a hidden cost.
Always. And it only reveals itself after the deal is done, after you're committed. Poofington just inverted it.
Yeah.
The contract was, in a twisted way, honest about the outcome being guaranteed, which is not the one the customer thought they were buying. The ruin was the real product.
And the actual transaction, the moment of the deal, was apparently very simple.
Yeah.
Very businesslike.
Startlingly so, based on the scant descriptions. No big spooky ritual, no arcane chanting, just a straightforward commercial exchange reinforcing that surface legitimacy.
It was all stripped down. The horror was in the consequence, not the process.
Right up until they walked out the door, starting that 1 year clock ticking down.
So the interaction might have been as simple as three wishes.
$150, no refunds.
That's it. That minimalism is chilling. No fine print, no magic words needed. The payment was the ritual. The contract was sealed with cash.
But let's circle back to that core idea, the reversal. Why is that so central to the legend? Why not just have him fail or disappear with the money? Why the perfect opposite?
Because theft makes him a criminal, right? Just a mundane crook.
Exactly. But the reversal, that makes him something else, an architect of ruin. It suggests this intelligence, this system that knows your hopes intimately enough to shatter them precisely.
You're not just robbed of money. You're robbed of your deepest intentions. Your future is actively unwritten and rewritten for the worse.
And that turns the whole story into this really sharp morality tale, doesn't it? A warning against seeking easy power, instant fixes. Because that power, the story warns, might be turned against you with absolute calculated precision.
It's the ultimate twisted, be careful what you wish for. Engineered for maximum suffering, maximum destruction, culminating in death. Grim stuff.
So these individual tragedies, the string of deaths connected to one shop, even on a busy pier, that sort of pattern couldn't stay under the radar forever, especially not in a tight-knit commercial community.
Right, people talk. Other shopkeepers would notice. Business might even drop off if the area near his shop got a bad reputation.
Precisely. And this is where the story makes a crucial shift. It moves from individual suffering and spooky rumors into collective documented action. The folklore starts to bleed into the official record.
Okay, so by 1927, things had reached a boiling point.
It seems so. The fear among the other peer vendors solidified into actual panic. They realized this wasn't just bad luck hitting Poofington's customers. It was potentially dangerous for everyone on the pier. It was bad for business, maybe even physically unsafe.
So they did something formal.
They did. They drew up and signed a collective petition, a documented formal request to the authorities to have Poofington legally removed, evicted.
Wow. Okay, so that petition, that's our anchor. That's real.
Absolutely. It's the cold, hard fact amidst all the weirdness. We might question the stories of wishes and reversals, but the shop owners' fear, their demand for action, that's documented. It shows genuine community distress leading to a formal bureaucratic process.
They weren't just whispering, they were signing their names, demanding official intervention.
Exactly. And crucially, why were they demanding it? It wasn't just the deaths, which, as you said, could maybe be explained away individually. It was the other stuff, the bizarre sightings associated with Poofington himself.
Ah, right. This is where it gets really strange. The petition didn't just say he's creepy and bad for business.
No. The documentation supporting the petition, according to our sources, includes these incredible claims. Multiple petitioners reported, and they apparently corroborated each other's stories that they had seen Poofington.
Wow.
Well.
Phelps loading.
Or drifting, as some sources put it, specifically above the pier boards at night.
Not just walking weirdly, but actually levitating off the ground.
The claims were explicit. He appeared to have no legs visible when doing this, just drifting over the wooden planks,
mm-hmm.
suspended in the air.
Okay, just picture that for a second. The other shopkeepers are locking up. It's dark, maybe foggy.
Mm-hmm.
And they see this guy, their neighbor, just floating silently between the stalls. Legless.
It's a profoundly disturbing image, isn't it? It transforms him instantly from a potential scam artist or even a curse monger into something fundamentally inhuman, a creature moving impossibly through their very mundane commercial space.
It's grotesque, a symbol of something unnatural right there among the legitimate businesses. No wonder they wanted him gone. That image alone would be enough.
And that image, that claim, being included in the official petition, that's the fascinating part, that tension between the documented fact, the petition exists, and the utterly fantastic claim the man floats, is what gives this folklore such power.
It connects the rational world of business and bureaucracy with the irrational fear of the supernatural.
Oh, it's here.
Pier meets the abyss again.
Precisely. The petitioners felt they had to include the impossible claim to justify the urgency, the depth of their fear, and their demand for removal.
It makes me think about how records handle things they can't explain. Like we've seen in other cases, the Real Wendy analysis, for example. The record freezes a moment.
Right. The petition freezes that moment in 1927. The fear, the demand, and crucially, the specific claim of levitation. It's locked in bureaucratic time.
But the story, the living myth of the floating man, that kept moving, kept terrifying people. It's the why behind the what of the petition.
Exactly. The fact that they put the levitation claim in writing to the authorities means they were essentially forcing the system to confront something it wasn't equipped for. Not just a nuisance neighbor, but an apparent violation of physical reality.
So the city authorities, they get this petition signed by multiple business owners. It mentions deaths, tragic circumstances, and, oh yeah, the guy floats. They couldn't just ignore that, could they?
Apparently not. Faced with a formal complaint, backed by multiple signatories and these disturbing reports, the police were finally compelled to act. Officers were dispatched to the pier.
And their job was basically eviction. Get him out of the lamp shop.
That seems to have been the official directive. Remove him from the premises. A standard enough police action on the surface.
But this is where the mundane procedure crashes headlong into, well, the climax of the legend.
But completely. The officers went in expecting, what, maybe some resistance, an argument, suing papers. Instead, what they encountered inside that shop was described later, again, hedging here based on the reports, as something out of a nightmare.
So the expectation versus the reality inside that dim shop was stark.
Absolutely staggering, according to the narrative that survived. They probably expected a dark, maybe dusty, cluttered little shop, right? Given the dim lamp shop name.
Yeah, maybe one flickering bulb.
But no. When they entered during this confrontation, the interior wasn't dim at all. It was the opposite. It was reportedly glowing with dozens of lamps.
Dozens. So incredibly bright.
Almost painfully so, is the description. A concentrated, intense light. And Poofington himself was right in the middle of it, at the epicenter of this unnatural illumination, surrounded by the very objects of his trade.
Okay, that's weird enough. But the floating, did the police see that too?
And this is the crucial link. The sources claim the police did witness it. They confirmed the petitioner's sightings. Poofington was, according to these accounts, levitating right there in the center of the glowing room.
So the police aren't dealing with a normal eviction anymore. They're facing a figure bathed in intense light, defying gravity.
Exactly. Imagine being one of those officers. Your training covers riots, theft, disputes. It doesn't cover glowing, floating lamp merchants. The psychological shock must have been immense.
So what happened? Did they try to arrest him, talk to him?
They reacted as officers likely would when confronting a suspect, even a bizarre one. They moved closer, they tried to apprehend him, and that's the climax. It's incredibly sudden. As the police stepped towards him, the sources say Poofington just looked right at them and vanished into thin air.
Vanished, like poof, gone. No struggle, no fight, no puff of smoke even, just absolute instantaneous cessation of presence. One moment there, glowing and floating, the next, nothing.
And he was never seen again. That's the official outcome.
That's the phrase used.
Yeah.
Total finality.
Yeah.
Nobody was ever found, obviously. No trial. No further sightings reported. Complete erasure from that spot, from the pier, from the record, essentially.
The law arrives.
Yeah.
Armed and ready, and the problem just deletes itself, defies them through non-existence. It's a stunning narrative climax. And that very absence, that void, becomes the final piece of evidence in a strange way.
How do you mean?
Well, if we think about frameworks used to analyze, say, political disappearances, like in the Klaus Richter studies we looked at, sometimes the erasure itself is the proof that something extraordinary happened. The empty shop, the police report that must have been incredibly difficult to write, the sudden stop to the wishes and the deaths. That absence is the evidence.
Evidence of something non-mundane, at least.
Yes. The story ends not with a resolution, but with a void, a complete deletion from the very commercial space he had corrupted. He didn't just leave. It's framed as if he was perhaps undone or simply chose to unexist from that context.
Leaving behind? What?
Yeah.
Just the lamps.
Just the glowing lamps, according to the story. The tools of his trade, the witnesses to the deals, the source of the light in that final confrontation, and an empty storefront on the pier. A gap that the community probably wanted to fill quickly, but the memory of which clearly lingered. Okay, so let's take a step back from the narrative itself and try to analyze Poofington on a deeper level. Not just as a ghost story figure, but as maybe a system.
A system. How so?
Well, he wasn't just randomly malicious. He offered a specific product, a guaranteed outcome. The twist was that the actual guarantee, the operational one, was for the perfect opposite, leading to ruin and death. It was a finely tuned machine for fatal reversal.
So, a system of control operating under the guise of a simple, if expensive, transaction.
Precisely. It looks like commerce, but it's actually a trap, built on a false promise, but executed with terrifying precision.
It's like playing a rigged game, but the rigging isn't just that you lose, it's that you lose in the most perfectly destructive way imaginable.
Exactly. And that connects to broader ideas we've explored about manipulative systems disguised as opportunity. Remember our discussion drawing on the Monopoly board game metaphor.
Yeah, the game trains you before it pays you. It teaches you the rules, the cycles.
Right. Poofington's game was a much darker version. It trained its victims in the brutal reality of consequence and reversal. It showed them the destructive power they'd bought into right before delivering the final payment, their death. That $150 wasn't a purchase price. It was more like an enrollment fee for a masterclass in ruin.
That's a chilling way to put it. And the lamps. We keep coming back to the lamps. The tools, the light source, the only things left behind. What's their symbolic role in all this?
They're crucial, I think. They're not just inventory. They are the artifacts of the system.
Yeah.
They provided the light for the final impossible act. They are the silent witnesses.
Like the weapon being a witness. That idea we discussed with the Luke Skywalker loing sources.
Exactly that archetype. The object endures after the actor is gone. The lamps saw the transactions. They symbolically illuminated the fatal contracts and they witnessed the vanishing. They're the only tangible remnants of Poofington's entire operation on that pier. They literally hold the light, or maybe the darkness, of the legend.
And we still have that nagging question. How did this zone of absolute tragedy operate so openly for so long on a public commercial pier for maybe a year? People were dying.
It is strange, isn't it? It speaks volumes about how easily something dangerous can be normalized if it adopts the appearance of normalcy.
Like it has a storefront, a price tag.
Precisely. It fits the pattern. If we connect this back to our analysis of controlled environments, like the Disney World example, control, even dangerous control, often hides most effectively right out in plain sight.
Because it looks like part of the system.
Yes. Poofington's deadly protocol was embedded within the pier's normal economy. A weird shop. Yes, maybe expensive, but still just a shop. Selling something. It took that accumulation of tragedy, the sheer number of deaths, plus the bizarre sightings, to finally break through that normalization and trigger the collective panic represented by the petition.
So the petition was the community finally recognizing, wait, this thing that looks like business is actually something else entirely, something dangerous.
They saw the dangerous controlled zone within their familiar space and demanded it be dismantled. They reacted before the authorities were forced to.
Which leads us, I suppose, to the final question for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
Why does this story stick around? Why Poofington? It's more than just don't buy magic wishes, isn't it?
Oh, much more. It's clearly not just a tale about a clever scammer who got away. It feels more like a very specific, very transactional warning about seeking power that's too easy, too quick, too transactional, especially when it comes with a guarantee. The legend screams at you, if the treasure seems too good to be true, if the promise is absolute. It's not just a trap. It might be something far worse, an engineered reversal waiting to happen. #tag outro.
So this deep dive, it was really traced a unique path, hasn't it? From that initial, shocking $150 deal.
Through the perfect, horrifying reversal of every wish.
To the very real fear escalating into that official petition.
Fueled by those incredible claims of levitation.
And culminating in that final, bizarre vanishing act right in front of the police. Total erasure.
It's a potent mix of commerce, folklore, fear, and the unexplainable, all concentrated on the edge of a California pier.
So what lingers? Is it the story of Poofington himself, this maybe supernatural entity? Or is it the system he represented, that warning about deals that seemed too perfect?
It's hard to say definitively he represented, perhaps, the hidden cost of desire, the danger lurking just beneath the surface of the ordinary transaction, the potential for ruin hiding in plain sight.
We're left, then, with that image, the empty space where his shot stood, the one place on that bright pier where the light wasn't safe, where it illuminated a fatal bargain. Is the legend a memory of what was lost there? Or is it the enduring power of the warning itself?
A question that hangs in the air, much like Poofington himself, perhaps, anchored only by an empty spot on a pier and a story that refuses to fade.
Every pier keeps a light burning for him just in case he comes back.